Welcome to AL.com's Triple Take. I'm Carla Jean Whitley.
I'm John Hammondry.
And I'm Edward Bowles.
Triple Take is a show where we discuss your favorite books, movies, and albums and how they shape your life.
Today's guest for our debut episode is Rick Bragg. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a best-selling author, and an instructor of writing at the University of Alabama. So I think it's pretty obvious that we were excited to get him on the show. He's also going to appear at the Alabama Book Festival in Montgomery tomorrow, April 23rd. So if you're listening to this before the event, you might want to point your car toward Montgomery to hear even more from Rick. But for this episode, we talked to him about To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, an obviously influential book, as well as the John Wayne film Red River and the music of Merle Haggard. So let's get started with Rick.
Miss Jean Louise. Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passed.
We'll start with a softball of a question. So you've been reading To Kill a Mockingbird lately. Of course, many, many, many of us, Alabamian writer or otherwise, consider that a hugely influential book. Do you remember when the first time you read it was?
I would have been in my early teens.
Okay.
And, I was in my early teens the first time, and it was an old ragged paperback that had looked like it had lain in the back window of an old Pontiac. It was yellowed and brittle. Mm-hmm. It might have even been come out the first paperback.
Okay.
And, you know, we were supposed to read it. We were told to read it. But there was something in the story. It wasn't just the morality play of the book. It's just a good story.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good read.
What did you take away, or do you recall what you took away from that first reading, and how might that have changed over the years?
I can't say that it opened my eyes to a great wrongdoing in the way that I'd been living my life, because I knew by the time I read that book that there was meanness and cruelty and backwardness. And how people dealt with people that were a different color from them. And I knew that was wrong, even as a small boy. I knew that was just ignorant. But what Harper Lee did was she put it in a story. You know, she affirmed the feelings of a lot of us, and especially a lot of us kids, a lot of us young people, and that was what was invaluable. She put it in a story. She put it in a sermon that didn't have any preaching in it.
Right.
You know, I didn't darken the door of many churches. You know, my kinfolks like to joke it. If I do walk in a church, the floor will split open and flames will lick up from the netherworld. But I knew even then that the best sermons were stories. David and Goliath. Things like that. And this was the perfect sermon.
Did that influence you in your own path as a writer?
I think we all learned something from her. I've always believed in color, imagery, and detail. That the richer the language is. Now, not overblown, not gothic, not florid, but the richer it is. Biscuit and gravy rich. The richer it is, then the more people are going to naturally get out of it. And, yeah, you know, she, Larry McMurtry, you know, Pat Conroy, Willie Morris, you know, a lot, you know, Charles Dickens, for, you know, who should have been a Southern writer. You know, they all had this great luster. So, yeah, you learn from them and you steal from them and you do the best you can with what's left in your head.
Yeah. So, you say Charles Dickens should have been a Southern writer. What do you mean by that?
Just, he is so very gothic in a good way. So very gritty. So, you know, there are morality plays mm-hmm. and sermons and page after page in Dickens. A Christmas Carol, which he wrote for money, is still one of the great sermons of our time, you know, about dealing with the poor. You know, these urchins on the street, you know, their names are want and ignorance. I'm probably misquoting Dickens, but their names are want and ignorance. And you can deal with them now, or you can deal with them later as they begin to tear back at the society that created them. Well, that's just common sense and common decency.
And to me, and I would not be surprised if you agree, but there's just so much power, like you said, in hearing that in story. I think that's the power of telling a story.
It's, you know, that old journalism boilerplate, show me, don't tell me. Paint people a picture and hang it on the air. They'll stick with you.
Yeah. And I sure think we can learn a lot from one another's stories in the process.
I hope so.
I mean, of course, we're sitting here speaking as two writers, so if we can't, you and I are probably in trouble. But
yeah, it's, you know, the good thing about writing stories that people care about is... it just seems to mean so much more than fiction. You know, nonfiction, I think that is the backbone of nonfiction is they look at those people, they look at those faces, know those people walk the earth, know those people lived, and still walk it.
Yeah. So I have to ask, just because of where we're sitting and because of the line of people who came through here before we sat down, how do you impart that mission and encourage that in your students?
Well, we preach it. You know, we preach imagery, detail, and color. I ask them if they've ever had a rice cake, and they raise their hands. And I ask them if they enjoyed the rice cake, and they say no. And I ask them if they ever had sausage gravy on a biscuit. They say, yeah. So then your writing needs to be savory like that. It needs to have that redolence in it. And yeah, I mean, you know, some of them get it. Some of them fight it. But, you know, teaching writing is to me, it's very gratifying because I believe in the craft. I believe in putting words together so that they don't fall down. So I enjoy that process. It can be tough, and it can, you know, be a little frustrating, but there is something in the dirt in our state that grows good writers. We know that. That is borne out again and again and again and again. But these young people will, you know, will be doing what I'm doing now in due time. I know that. Don't want to talk in cliches, but you really do sometimes try not to mess a good writer up. You know, leave them in their voice. Leave them in the things that they do well. Don't try to peel that away and remake them. You know, I'm not a marine drill instructor. I don't want to tear them down and build them back. Besides, that's too much work.
Well, before we wrap up, I did want to ask, you know, we've been talking, taking off on To Kill a Mockingbird as sort of a touchstone, but, well, I wanted to ask, one, did you have opportunity to meet Harper Lee?
I did. I met her. We met only once. We passed each other in motion a lot, but, and it was a few years ago, and... you know, I have very few heroes in this craft that I had a chance to reach out and shake their hand. And I don't want to gush. I'm not much of a gusher. It's unseemly for a man my size. But, you know, she wrote the book that would become almost a gospel. Wayne Flint, one of the smartest men I know, referred to it as Harper Lee's gospel. So, you know, if I, and it was as if I had met Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. It was as if I had had a chance to meet some of these other Southern greats that I have on my bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And it was a great pleasure. And she was very kind to me.
I must confess I'm jealous, but that's very cool. And then finally, did you read Go Set a Watchman?
I have not read it yet. I read part of it, and I will read it, I believe. But to be brutally honest, and usually when a Southerner says that, you better roll your pants legs up. But to be brutally honest, we've had two books out in the past 2 years, mm-hmm. and two book tours in the past 2 years, and you can either write a book or read one. It is very difficult to do both.
Yep.
But when Miss Lee passed away, I picked up the mm-hmm. copy of To Kill a Mockingbird and started reading. First, I just kind of skipped around, and then I went back to the beginning and started reading it again. Mm-hmm. Did the same thing with Pat Conroy when he passed. Yeah. I picked up Prince of Tides. My mother's favorite book is not any one of mine. It's The Water is Wide by Pat Conroy.
Jerry was right. You're soft. You should have let him kill me, because I'm going to kill you. I'll catch up with you. I don't know when, but I'll catch up. Every time you turn around, expect to see me. There's one time you'll turn around and I'll be there. I'm going to kill you, Matt.
So what do you love about Red River?
I think the fact that, for one, I'm not a movie nerd.
Okay.
I wish I was. But there are scenes in Red River. Like there's a scene where it's the break of day and the cowboys are getting ready to start this trail drive. Mm-hmm. And the camera focuses tight in on their faces. And they just start screaming. You know, the cowboy equivalent of giddy up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's John Ford who did that, I think, right?
It was a Howard Hawks movie, John Wayne, right. And Montgomery Clift.
John Wayne, Montgomery Clift, and Walter Brennan.
But John Ford did see the movie, right. And after he saw it, he said, well, hell, I didn't know John Wayne could act.
Right.
So then he started doing the John Wayne.
Right. Is that the way that
happened? Yeah,
but I there was just something beautiful about the way it was shot.
Yeah.
And you know, every boy who grows up in the country, mm-hmm. you know, looking into a pasture fence, wants to be the tall man on the horse.
But it's interesting you picked that one, because, you know, when people think, well, John Wayne was always a good guy, there's always the searchers where they say, well, he was kind of a bad guy in that mm-hmm. movie. But in Red River, I mean, he's a son of a bitch. Like, he, you know, is abusive to his adopted son.
Cruel.
He shoots, I guess, two Mexicans and basically steals their land and claims it as his own. Is there a reason why you gravitate towards the darker John Wayne movie?
Because I think that's the way it was.
Yeah.
I think that Red River is... I don't think that gun hands necessarily shoot 10 cans out of the air 14 times mm-hmm. before they hit the ground. But I think that John Wayne's brutality mm-hmm. and cruelty in Red River was the way it had to be.
Right.
It had very much the feel, that cruelty, that, you know, the whipping of the man... You know, when he was going to whip the man who stole sugar for starting the stampede, when he's going to whip him, that felt a lot like Larry McMurtry, felt a lot like Cormac McCarthy, felt a lot like Pete Dexter.
Yeah.
Felt a much more real West.
Yeah, I agree. I think that and The Searchers and High Noon...
Right.
The reason why those have stood the test of time is that right. they have those darker elements, and it's not
right.
It's not just a...
Well, High Noon is also a favorite of mine, but there was something about Wayne's character in this. And it's not just the intensity Hobbit. It's not just the big mean man, you know, striding through, you know, the dust. It was the fact that there's desperation in him.
Yeah.
You know, as he does it. And you want to see cruelty push somebody into a corner.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, if you don't mind me asking that, obviously in All Over But the Shelton, you talked about your father. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, you know, that plays into you gravitating towards this father figure who is desperate and is abusive, but who is ultimately good in the end. I mean,
yeah, I wish my daddy's story had been that perfect.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that he would have made that turn. And maybe that's one of the reasons why Red River is such a favorite of mine, because you know, Wayne does redeem himself at the last second.
Yeah.
And he has to have help.
Yeah.
You know, but mostly it is the visuals in that
mm-hmm.
that movie. The you know, Westerns, it's still larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
It's still got gunplay and, you know, and running horses, and, you know, it's got everything you want in a good Western. It's got Mexican bandits. It's got everything you possibly can want.
Well, and for a 1948 film, and we talk a lot about now about, like, revisionist history and all that, but that does a pretty good job of talking about, you know, they have to travel to Missouri because the South is too poor to pay for cattle right. because they lost the war, and the way that some Texans got their land from the Mexicans. It's a, I mean, progressive might not ever be the right word for a John Wayne film, but it's an accurate, or it feels accurate.
I think it's just much more realistic than, yeah. Look, you know, I love Westerns. I've always loved Westerns. But so many are just so silly.
That's
and
true.
So, you know, you got, you know, all the cowboys and Indian movies are just fundamentally goofy.
Yeah.
They're just goofy. The Searchers was a wonderful portrayal by Wayne.
Yeah, it was.
But there's silliness in it. You know, there's just such kind of, John Ford's movies have a lot of silliness in them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, so you go from these majestic shots and these beautiful shots to some goofy fist fight where it's pantomime.
Yeah, or somebody doing a flip off a horse. Or
right,
just, like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And but I think that the beautiful thing about Red River was it had almost none of that.
Yeah.
I mean, the violence was believable, most of it. Mm-hmm. And like broken glass, it had that feel of grit to it. And I think that's why it was, and there was some pretty good dialogue in it.
Yeah,
it wasn't great,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, for a movie 1948, that's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there is a scene where Walter Brennan gambles away his store-bought teeth.
Uh-huh.
And the man he loses them to, an Indian,
uh-huh.
you know, will only let him have them at supper time.
Yeah, you can't beat that. That's great. Well, and it sounds like you're gravitated towards outlaws in general, because you're the musician you've chosen to talk about this week is Merle Haggard. That's
sure.
A great outlaw country guy.
Yeah.
Talking a little earlier, and you said the album that you're listening to right now, you're listening to a lot of Merle Haggard, and as you know, we just lost him a few weeks ago. So tell me a little bit about your connection with him and why his music resonates.
I hate his most popular song, and I know a lot of people will probably come throw rocks at my mailbox.
Which
but
song?
Okie from Muskogee is a ridiculous song.
I am so glad that you agree with me. Yes, because I totally agree. But go ahead.
And it's not even a Merle Haggard song. It's a ridiculous song. He didn't feel that. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not the patriotism. The patriotism, I'm sure he felt.
Right.
As do I. As do most of us who, you know, who who listened to a country music song about defiance and about the changing world,
right.
and we you know, it harkens. I know the theme of it harkens to a, you know, to maybe a time where people understood the world a little better.
Right.
But you just get the feeling that here you have one of the all-time great country music outlaws singing this song, and you know he did it, parts of it, with a wink, you know, with a little bit of a wink.
And I always wonder that, because going back and listening to it now, you know, mm-hmm. in the 2000s, it always felt like I couldn't tell if there was a hint of sarcasm there or if it was, this is how I feel hard and fast, because so many people take it to heart.
Well, you know, again, it might have been the time. He might, you know, is when I was a kid and I would listen to Johnny Horton,
mm-hmm.
you know, the great, you know, country music balladeer. You know,
right.
He'd sing all these great ballads. And he would sing about patriotism, and it'd make your blood run cold, boy. I mean, you know,
right.
He'd sing about the War of 1812, the Battle of New Orleans. He'd sing about, you know, we got to sink the Bismarck because the world depends on us. And he'd sing these songs, and man, you'd get, your blood would get up, and you wanted to go out and fight a war.
Right.
You wanted to go out and fight, you know, pick a fight. You know, pick a fight with somebody, you know, and even a big country. Pick a fight with a big country, you know. And I think that what was going on in the world at that time, you know, Merle wrote an anthem for that.
Right.
But Merle was, you know, deep in his heart, he was more of an outlaw than that song, you know, portrays. And, you know, when the songs that I loved of Merle's were probably the best love song ever written, That's the Way Love Goes.
Right.
The songs I love were Rainbow Stew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that song was almost written for my people who worked for the WPA. My people did ride freight cars.
Right.
You know, chasing work. They'd take their roofing tools with them, hop a freight. And you know, they fought railroad bulls. They lived that life that he sang about in Rainbow Stew. You know, Willie Nelson and Merle singing Poncho and Lefty.
Right.
I used the lyrics to that. That was a, the great songwriter. Dadgummit. I'm ashamed of myself. But I used those lyrics. Townsman Sam.
Okay, lyrics. Yes.
I used those lyrics at the beginning of my first book. You know, but the thing I loved about Merle Haggard was, he really was, and this is far from an original thought, but he was our, meaning people who love country music, he was our Sinatra.
Right.
He had a voice that most of us, if I had his voice, I'd go sit in the dirt and sing to myself.
And the thing that makes Hag so memorable, you know, to this day, 2016, is because his lyrics has really spoke to the working man. And I think to this day, it speaks to working Alabama.
Oh, absolutely.
And when we posted on AL.com his death, I had never seen just such an outpouring from all of our commenters about how much he meant to them. Why do you think that all these years, it can still resonate and just span generations of Alabamians? Those lyrics can still just hit a tone.
Well, I think part of it is, and again, I think it goes back to songs like "Okie from Muskogee." You know, he's singing to their disappointments and their fears and their defiance,
right.
And their hopes too. You know, he's got a song, as you know, called "Working Man,"
right?
"Working Man's Blues."
Right.
He's got the ability, much like Hank Williams. To what Hank could do that was remarkable was Hank Williams spread our pain out thin enough in those songs to where we could stand it.
Mm.
You know, he would, you know, a man whose son called another man daddy.
Right.
You know, he could take those everyday pains, loving a woman that don't love you. He took those everyday pains and he spread them out in that music so thin enough to where we could bear it. And I think that Merle Haggard was a master at singing our pain back at us.
And he did it with such simplicity. And I think that's what really helps to make that connect. And as you said, it's had a bit of influence on your own writing. So tell me a little bit more about how his structure, storytelling, lyricism has kind of influenced your own writing.
Well, you know, writing's an aesthetic. And, you know, all it is an aesthetic. It can be a sermon. It can be a great gospel. It can be a lecture. It can be a great education if you do it right.
Right.
I don't know if I've ever done it that way, but it can be that
way. Your students may say something
different. But I think that writing is, first and foremost, is, you know, it's storytelling, and there is an, it needs to be pretty. You know, right. God help us. It needs to, you know, be full of imagery, detail, and color. As I said earlier, and we were talking about writing. And Merle Haggard has this line about losing his lover in Kern River.
Mm.
And there's this beautiful line where he says, and I can't sing, but I may cross on the highway, but I'll never swim Kern River again.
Right.
And it's little things like that. In Rainbow Stew, eating rainbow stew with a silver spoon underneath the sky blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. And all it is looking for a better time, you know, looking for a better time somewhere down the road. If we can make it through December, everything's going to be all right.
In the realm of education, how can young writers, up-and-coming writers, kind of learn the lessons that he preached through his songs and apply that to their own writing?
Well, first we got to get them to listen to him.
Yeah.
You know, I get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but, you know, pop country. Pop country is an assault on the senses. It is such a miserable...
We can go another 30 minutes with me agreeing with you there.
Isn't it awful?
It's so boiled down to sugar saccharin, but I'll let you go ahead.
I'll move over. Someone asked me once, do you mind if I put on some, and it was some modern day country music artist who was, you know, popular because he looked good in a pair of jeans. And I don't know if Merle ever gave much thought to...
I don't think, you know, he did.
He picked out some cool hats, but I just told the guy, I mean, I was being honest, I said, if you turn that on, I will throw myself in the moving car. there is no soul in it. Merle Haggard had soul in his work. I was listening to Aretha Franklin.
Yes.
Now, it's a close race. I know that, you know, they're very different, but it's a close race to me. If I had to listen to somebody on a long trip, Merle Haggard's greatest hits or Aretha Franklin's greatest hits or maybe Stevie Wonder's greatest hits or maybe, Hank Sr., you know, the country group Alabama.
Right.
Great ballads.
Right.
But, you know, Sam Cooke, you know. But what they all had in common was this beautiful storytelling and this connection to real people.
Yes.
And, Aretha singing about men doing her wrong and, you know, Sam Cooke singing about can't borrow no money from his brother. That's life, and I know this is cliched. I know that, but modern country. I said that if I ever heard a song, a country music song about a Yeti cooler, that I would turn off my radio for good, and I would never listen to another country music song again. And not a modern one. And I was sitting the other day, and I turned my radio on, and before I could get to it, because usually when I hear modern day country, I stab at the radio like a snake.
I can't blame
you. And I was stabbing at it, but before I could, I heard these words. Something about, I know what people say, money can't buy everything.
Right.
But it'll buy me a boat. It'll buy me a truck to pull it. It'll buy me a Yeti. Cooler full of silver bullets. And I could, man, I hurt my finger stabbing at the... And I knew then that the world as I knew it, but what I really knew was I'm obsolete. I'm obsolete. I am I'm a nice rambler, I'm an ice cream machine. I'm obsolete because if that's what country is, then I am a geezer.
But it doesn't. It might be what it is, but it doesn't have to be that way. Because if you look back at Sam and Aretha, Right. Those songs came from emotion. And that's Right. Why 60 years later it still hits. Because Right. It came from a place of emotion. It didn't come from a place of fads and things like Right. That. Right. So I think that one thing that really makes good, strong writing, songwriting or whatever, is a place that comes from real feeling and emotion.
Yeah. What I try to do is I try to like today I had them bring in a line or a page, a poem, a song lyric, something that speaks to them.
Right.
And they brought in everything from classic literature to obscure song lyrics. You know, I brought two of my own. One is, I'll really show my age, but Gordon Lightfoot.
Okay.
Remember Gordon Lightfoot?
Yes, I know.
Remember
Gordon.
The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald?
Yes.
Well, you know, Gordon is singing about the waves crashing and breaking down the hatch, the main hatchway caved in. These waves drowning these men. And the Great Lakes, cold Great Lakes. What was it? The Witch of November, or
yes,
something like that.
Right.
There's this line where he says, "Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours?" And so, you know, I tell them that the beauty of the language is in every song that speaks to them. It's in every passage of literature. Read the first page of Dickens. Read the first page of Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea.
Right.
As he writes about the sail fluttering in the wind like a perpetual flag of defeat. Read McMurtry's Lonesome Dove.
Right.
Read Pete Dexter's Deadwood. Read Eudora Welty's story about the death of Medgar Evers. Where is the voice coming from?
Right.
Read, God Almighty, but also listen for it in... It's in Faulkner's. I don't quote Faulkner much, but Faulkner's Nobel Prize address is remarkably beautiful. But also listen to it in language. Listen to it. Their mothers, their fathers, their grandmothers, their grandfathers, their uncles. All I do comes from the way my people talk, the rhythms and the cadences, the dialect of the mountains. I'm not a flatland guy. I'm not a delta guy. I'm not saying there's not beauty there. I know that on a stoop in New Orleans right now, somebody's talking poetry.
You know it.
You know. But my people, mountain people, and that mix of, that old Scots-Irish mix of, like, mountain, just massacre of the language with old, like, queen and country dialect put together, yet in New Orleans I would listen to people who would mix, you know, they mix some French in with their language.
Right.
And I'd sit there and think, God, I wish I could talk like that. So, you know, but so I tell them, you know, listen to each other, you know, but more than anything, I don't want to be a touchy-feely guy. I've never been a touchy-feely guy. But it's all around them. And, you know, if you don't read good works, then you'll fail. If you don't listen to music that has heart and soul in it, and it doesn't matter what color or background it originates from, I probably have, I've got the Temptations in my CD changer. I'm so old-fashioned, I got a CD changer.
So do I.
You know, but I got the Temptations, big band music, Steve Earle, the Rolling Stones and Allman Brothers, Aretha, and I think the Ohio Players.
All right, now.
You know, and as a matter of fact, I know the Ohio Players. And that takes me back to high school. But, I tell my kids to listen to Sam Cooke. I tell them to listen to, my God, you know, listen to Muddy Waters.
Right.
Listen to, Howlin' Wolf was something altogether different, man. There might not necessarily have been a lot of poetry in Howlin' Wolf, but there was gut in it and emotion.
It wasn't so much poetry as it was just, as you said, emotion.
Yeah, yeah.
Heartfelt.
Right. Emotion. It was a driving thing. I mean, it was a driving, it was like a hammer striking something over and over again. You listen to his voice and
you feel it. Exactly.
Oh, gosh, yeah, you feel it. And you felt heat in it. And, you listen to the harp of Little Walter.
Yes.
And tell me that there's not death and dying and misery and sadness. I don't know if there's much hope in his. You know what I mean? I don't know if there's much hope in it. But there was living in his harp. And that wasn't even a word. You know, it wasn't even a word. I mean, you know, it was just the sound of that. And I tell my kids that, you know, writing is visceral. It is, must be redolent with all this flavor. And if it is not redolent with all this flavor, it will fail.
Every time. The foundations of good lyrics, good writing, heart and emotion.
Yeah, absolutely. And gut. And a balled up fist. You know, that's what I think it was Tennessee Williams wrote that all my life, I've been a bunched up fist, all my life I've been a bunched up fist, smashing, pounding, driving. That can be pretty too. So
there's beauty in that pain.
Right.
One that hits you and
right.
sticks with you.
Yeah.
Rick, thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. This is easy.
I'll be drinking that free bubble up, eating some rainbow stew.
Thanks so much to Rick for that insightful, wonderful conversation. We had a ball interviewing him, and we hope that you had just as much fun listening in.
And a reminder that tomorrow, April 23rd, you can see Rick at the Alabama Book Festival in Montgomery, Alabama. It is a free event, so head that way if you want to hear from Rick and lots of other authors.
Thanks, everyone. This was John Hammontree. You can follow me on Twitter at John Hammontree or on Instagram at @BirminghamMontree.
Edward Bowser, you can follow me at ETBOWSER on Twitter, ET Bowser.
I just like thinking of Bowser from Super Mario whenever you say that.
It's like ET the alien and Bowser from Mario.
Awesome.
What you look like.
This will be your last podcast, Hammontree.
And I'm Carla Jean Whitley. You can find me on several social networks at @InkStainedLife or just search my name, Carla Jean Whitley. We'll look forward to talking with y'all again on the next episode.